Today's lesson's difficult. I really struggled with this. Hope I can faithfully reproduce what the Lord wants you guys to hear today. But we're kind of continuing from last week. We're at the end of Mark chapter 11, verses 27 through to the end, and then through Mark 12. And you'll recall from last week's study, Jesus is undergoing and fulfilling the prophecies of the Passover, where from the 10th of Nisan until the 14th of Nisan, the national lamb, the perfect lamb, is being observed to make sure that he has no blemish before he is slaughtered on the 14th of Nisan. Now, where we are in Mark 11, it's still Tuesday, the 12th of Nisan, and I explained that there was some controversy about Good Friday versus other days. If it's Tuesday, the 12th, when is the 14th? Thursday. So that's why I gave you a whole page of footnotes to look that over.
So really, it's Wednesday night to start.
It would be Wednesday night. That's the 14th of Nisan. Thank you for clarifying that. So that's the other confusion, is we're not even using days in the same form. Days begin at dusk. So at this point, though, it's during the day. We can assume it's Tuesday, the 12th of Nisan. And Jesus is now teaching in the outer courtyards that he had cleared out on the prior day. As you'll recall, that this is all described in Exodus chapter 12, verses 3 through 6. Tell the whole community of Israel that on the 10th day of this month, each man is to take a lamb for his family, one for each household. Take care of the lamb until the 14th day of the month, when all the members of the community of Israel must slaughter them at twilight. We think Halloween's bad. That's a tough holiday. Anyway, Jesus is teaching now in those outer courtyards, and they've been freshly swept away from the money changers and the animals being sold, and so there's probably room for a large number of people to listen to him, and they are excitedly listening to his teaching, and the priests and the scribes are standing there seething with anger and jealousy. And we'll see why here as we go through this. This chapter through chapter 12 is a series of dialogues. And the parallel passages in Luke chapter 20 and in Matthew chapter 23 go into much more detail than Mark even does, explaining the back and forth. And so I'm going to divide the lesson up into two basic subjects that are covered in a series of dialogues or confrontations or debates. Now, the Pharisees and the Sadducees and the Herodians and the scribes, four different groups of people, each test him at some point in the discussion here. And they each come with their own assumptions and their own presuppositions. Okay? And the problem is that they're blind, okay, to the fact that he really is the Messiah. They can't handle this, and we'll explain a little bit why. And when they seek to test him, what they're really trying to do is confirm their own biases. In science, we call this confirmation bias. In science, daily confirmation bias is defined as a phenomenon where decision makers actively seek out and then assign more weight to the evidence that confirms their hypothesis, but ignore or underweight evidence that could disprove their hypothesis. We call that selective hearing, right? So the hypothesis that the scribes and the Pharisees and the Herodians had was that Jesus is a fraud. Okay, he can't be right. They just know he's wrong. For example, listen to the situation in John chapter 7. This is earlier in the ministry when at one point they sent the temple police to arrest him. So they send they put an APB out and send a squad car out to apprehend Jesus, and then they come back. And the temple police come back to the chief priests and the Pharisees, and they say, "Well, where is he? Why haven't you brought him?" And the police guys say, "Oh, no, you don't understand. No guy's ever spoken like this." And the Pharisees respond, and this reveals their bias. They respond to the police, "Are you fooled too? Have any of the rulers or the Pharisees believed in him? But this crowd that follows him around, they don't know the law, and they are accursed. And that's in John 7, 45 through 49, which I slightly paraphrased. Here's the thing. Whenever the Pharisees make some kind of declaration like that, they're wrong, because Nicodemus, who was the leader, was secretly a follower of Jesus. So their assumption is wrong. So on Tuesday, Jesus is showing himself to be superior in these dialogues in every way, in holiness and knowledge and in perception. And the intentions of his challengers will be revealed for the hypocrisy and the error that they have. At the time that they confront Jesus, I'm setting this up in the introduction here, his challengers are either humiliated or humbled. In each case, Jesus doesn't leave any ground in the middle. There's no middle ground for his adversaries to remain undecided. When we read the scripture, we're challenged to either rethink our assumptions and recognize that we're wrong, or, unfortunately, some people leave with their hearts hardened. Jesus does not allow you to withhold commitment to him. He eventually forces you to make a decision through events in your life. He will not allow you to expect you to withhold commitment and then demand commitment from him. In Luke 9, verse 26, we read, and this is Jesus speaking, "For whoever is ashamed of me and my words, the Son of Man will be ashamed of him when he comes in his glory and the glory of the Father and the holy angels." That's kind of a scary thought. Hey, if you're not going to commit to me, when it's time for me to advocate for you, I pass. That's a frightening thought. But Jesus forces you to make that decision. So here we are, setting this all up for these dialogues, that Jesus is being confronted by different factions of the Jewish leadership and is being tested, and he's found blameless in every situation. Now, before we get into the first division, just as a thought for us, in today's politically correct world, which is completely filled by the influence of the devil and evil spiritual forces, the whole world system is designed to silence and embarrass Christians, isn't it? To try to slow the spread of the gospel. And we would do well to examine how Jesus confronted his challengers and learn from him, because, like it or not, we are being observed and challenged by unbelievers just as Jesus was. So now let's look at our first division. I've entitled this, "The Arrogant Leadership of Israel Challenges the Authority of Jesus Even as They Fail to Understand His Power and the Scriptures that Announce His Arrival." So the first set of dialogues involves the chief priests and scribes, and they're failing to understand his source of authority. If you'll recall, back in Matthew 9:34, they actually accused him of performing miracles under the power of the prince of demons, which they called Beelzebub. So in this dialogue in Mark 11, we see the scribes and the elders coming and asking Jesus, "By what authority are you doing these things? Who gave this authority to you?" And Jesus, knowing their false pretense, the false pretense of their question, said, "Okay, you answer a question from me, and then I will tell you by what authority that I have." And then he proceeded to ask them about John the Baptist, whom they had been complicit in his murder. So they had the wrong motives in asking. And when they wouldn't answer him, he said, "Fine, I'm not going to give you the satisfaction of knowing by what authority I have." A second group challenged him. These are the Herodians. These are the politicians in Mark 12, verses 13 through 17. They tried to confuse the power of God in the religious sphere from the delegated power that God gives in the government sphere. So the first group approached him with the wrong motives. The second group approaches him with the wrong assumption. "Is it lawful to pay taxes to Caesar or not?" they ask. Well, Jesus told them, give to Caesar the things that belong to Caesar, and God the things that are God. That's well established in the Scripture. Should we obey, is the right question here is, should we obey those whom God delegates with authority? Well, duh, right? Wouldn't you obey at your job somebody who's assigned by the president of the company to be your boss? Or do you say, well, I don't have to obey you, I only obey the CEO? Well, the CEO delegated that authority to be your boss. So you can see that they're testing him, but they have the wrong assumptions. And that's because they didn't pay attention to what was already taught in the Scriptures about delegated authority in government. You remember when we were talking about Nebuchadnezzar and Daniel and how God raises up and then destroys kingdoms? He raises them up. Finally, we have the Sadducees who deny the power of the resurrection. So they approach Jesus with a busted theology. They're wrong from the get-go. Some Sadducees who say there is no resurrection came to him and questioned him. They asked about this hypothetical situation with this woman. And they said, in the resurrection, when they rise, whose wife will she be with since seven had married her? And Jesus told them, you're deceived because you don't know the Scriptures and you don't understand the power of God. Now concerning the dead being raised, haven't you read in the book of Moses the passage about the burning bush, how God spoke to Moses and told him, I am the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. Now this is 430 some odd years after Jacob has passed away. And Jesus says, he is not the God of dead, but of the living, and you are badly deceived. So then Jesus has had enough, and by verse 35, he puts an end to the spurious questions. So Jesus asked this question as he taught in the temple complex. How can the scribes say that the Messiah is the son of David? Okay, genealogically speaking, the Messiah will come from David, right? But David says by the Holy Spirit, the Lord declared to my Lord, sit at my right hand until I put your enemies under your feet. Now David calls him, i.e. the Messiah, Lord. How then can the Messiah also be his son? Because in their culture, a son was never greater than the father, ever. So there must be something else at work here that's divine. And I love this. Mark adds, and the large crowd was listening to him with delight. They get it. They see these pompous, arrogant, frustrating leaders who put all these rules on them and political correctness, you know, the grammar Nazis. And they're watching Jesus just pummel these guys. They're probably eating popcorn. It's probably wonderful. So during this testing, then, each party comes with false intentions, false assumptions, and false theology. And Jesus, even though they're trying to trap him for their invalid motives, comes away blameless. And the question of Jesus' authority is what's frustrating to them, because the way Jesus taught was different than the way any of the scribes or Pharisees taught in the culture at that time. And I hope, for the sake of Trevor, I'm not misinterpreting this. But the way the rabbis taught back then, and even to this day, is very much the way a lawyer, an attorney, would do a brief. In that each point that they're making, each concept that they're trying to flesh out or defend, that position is then cited by some precedent, by some authority figure, usually a highly respected rabbi in history. So they would always defend their theological point or their position by someone else. But remember in Matthew 5, when Jesus is teaching at the Sermon on the Mount, and he would say, well, you've heard it said of old, meaning you remember all these old dead rabbis back here teaching XYZ about divorce or anger or murder. But I tell you. Now that's very controversial in that culture. And then he proceeds to redefine the definition of what murder is. Well, if you say raka to your brother, idiot, basically. And then you go to the altar. I'm sorry, but God's viewing you as a murderer. This was staggering to the people because they'd never heard a rabbi teach this way before. And probably back then, they taught a lot like in some of the churches today where you hear all this mumbo-jumbo theological murmuring and whatnot. And Jesus was speaking to them as people, and they understood it. This drove the Pharisees and the priests crazy. In Luke 4, he even emphasizes this when he says, he was teaching them on the Sabbaths, and the people were astonished at his teaching, for his word came with authority. In summary then, what we have here is a situation where Jesus is being tested by these four different groups, and then he takes the initiative to teach them what really actually belongs to God and what belongs to men, and what the proper authority structure is of his ministry. So we have a principle here. Christ's authority is from himself. He has authority over all creation. You see, it's only through the death and resurrection that he's about to go through that he will fulfill the sign of Jonah and validate his authority and his origin. And as a witness to all this, if you'll recall, the Father commanded with an audible voice at his transfiguration to the disciples, listen to him, so that they would stay the course when Jesus goes through all this and is crucified and resurrected again. We've also learned that from Jesus' teaching to the disciples in Mark 9, that those who exalt themselves, like these people that were testing him, will be humbled. But those who humble themselves before God will be exalted. For example, in Matthew 23, and this is in the parallel passage if you're reading through the harmonies, he says, and do not call anyone on earth your father, for one is your father, and it is he who is in heaven. And do not be called leaders, for one is your leader, and that is Christ. In other words, he's saying, I'm your leader. But the greatest among you shall be your servant, and whoever exalts himself shall be humbled, and whoever humbles himself shall be exalted. So Jesus is trying to establish what is the proper authority structures in the universe, and these testing, these preening, posturing people that think that they're in authority are confused. It's really God that's in charge. Jesus actually calls them out specifically for being guilty of pridefully arrogating to themselves authority that's not really theirs. In verse 38, down at the end of Mark 12, Jesus says, he also says in his teaching, beware of the scribes who want to go around in long robes and who want greetings in the marketplace and in front seats in the synagogue and places of honor at banquets. And yet they devour widows' houses and say long prayers just for show. And these will receive harsher punishment. He's being tested by these folks, and he is pushing back twice as hard. Twice as hard. Well, the Pharisees have hardened their stance now. This period of testing in the Passover is to serve a purpose. And you're either humbled or you're humiliated. And the Pharisees hardened their stance against Jesus and going forward continually question his authority and origin even after the resurrection. They deny the resurrection and they remain rebellious until their authority is taken from them by Rome in 70 AD. Now, if you're reading in the harmony, the parallel passages, Mark kind of gives you the quick newspaper version, but Matthew goes into much more detail. I just want to quickly summarize at the point that he's criticizing the scribes and the Pharisees for devouring widows' houses. He then pronounces 8 woes. And this is a devastating, devastating monologue. I'll just highlight it. It's in Matthew 23:14-36. And I'll just read a couple of the woes to give you a feel. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, because you devour widows' houses, even for a pretense. So that was the first one that's covered in Mark. Then he says, "Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, because you travel about on sea and land to make one proselyte, and then he becomes twice as much the son of hell as you." Wow, that's brutal. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you tithe mint and dill and cumin. You squeeze through the eye of the needle over little things, but you've neglected the weightier provisions of the law, including justice and mercy and faithfulness. So he continues through there, and then at the end he says, "Therefore I am sending you the prophets and the wise men and scribes, and some of them you will kill and crucify, and some of them you will scourge in your synagogues and persecute from city to city, that upon you may fall the guilt of all the righteous blood shed on earth, from the blood of the righteous Abel to the blood of Zechariah, the son of Berechiah, whom you murdered between the temple and the altar. Truly I say to you, all these things will come upon this generation." That was all part of this set of dialogues. You missed that in Mark. But it really got ugly on Tuesday. And his prophetic truth came true on 70 AD. It happened to that generation. Now, the other issue regarding the authority then that he clears up in this principle that Christ's authority is from himself is taught in John chapter 7, verses 18 through 24. Jesus asserts that his teachings are directly from the Father. I'll read starting in verse 15. "Then the Jews were amazed and said, 'How is it that he knows the scriptures since he hasn't been formally trained?' And Jesus answered them, 'My teaching isn't mine, it's from the one who sent me. If anyone wants to do his will, then he will understand whether the teaching is from God or whether I'm speaking on my own.'" In other words, listen to my words, and it should be apparent to you that I'm speaking from the Father. By the way, just as a sidebar, going off topic a little, have you ever wondered aloud if Jesus claimed to be God in the Scriptures? This is something that I get from skeptics all the time. And in this same set of teachings, in John 7, verses 28, and also in John 8, verses 42 through 50, he does intimate that he is the Son of God and has divine origin. In John 7:28, we read, "As he was teaching in the temple complex, Jesus cried out, 'You know me, and you know where I am from, and yet I have not come on my own, but the one who sent me is true, and you don't know him. I know him, because I am from him, and he sent me.'" Now that is a pretty blunt assessment of where his authority is. In John 8, later then, he's arguing with the Pharisees, and he says, "If God were your Father, you would love me, because I came from God, and I am here now. But I didn't come on my own. He sent me." They start arguing with him, and they said, he tells them, "Your father Abraham was overjoyed that he would see the day that I came." And they replied, "You aren't even 50 years old yet. How is it that you've seen Abraham?" And he replied to them, "I assure you, before Abraham was, I am." And at that point, they picked up stones to throw at him, but Jesus was hidden and went out of the temple complex. That's where he is stating, "I am God." So, just recall from our study of Mark thus far that he had the authority over nature. He calmed the seas, calmed the Sea of Galilee in the storm. He had authority to heal sickness, blindness, deafness, demon possession, right? He was able to heal paralytics, and he even raised people from the dead, such as Jairus' daughter. His miracles were a testimony from the Spirit, and then, as we said before, he had the audible testimony of the Father at the Transfiguration. So this brings us to the second set of issues that were being argued, the second division, and that is that Jesus is explaining to the people what is owed to God and what is owed to government and what the authority structure is that's delegated by God. He sets the stage with a parable that describes the rebellious Jewish leaders. And I love it because at the end of the parable, they go, I think he's talking about us. And it's the parable of the vineyard that we read in Mark 12. A man planted a vineyard and then he leased it to tenant farmers. He leased it. They're not the owners. He leased it to the tenant farmers and at harvest time sent to collect some of the fruit. So he had an expectation to receive a return on his investment. But when he finally had to send the heir, the tenants said, come, let's kill him and the inheritance will be ours. Do you see how they suddenly, they twisted it around. Wait a minute, we're the renters. Oh, but if we kill the landlord, then we own the house. Somehow, I don't see quite how that works, but come, let us kill him and the inheritance will be ours. So they seized him and killed him and threw him out of the vineyard. Therefore, what will the owner of the vineyard do? He will come and destroy the farmers and give the vineyard to someone else. Haven't you read the scripture? The stone that the builders rejected has become the cornerstone. And then they're thinking this through, and they knew that he was quoting Psalm 118. And they said, we knew that this parable was against us. I know, let's look for a way to arrest him. So Jesus' choice of this parable was no accident. He's setting the stage here for another set of dialogues with them. And the scribes and Pharisees who prided themselves in memorizing large portions of Scripture did understand that he was referring to them. Probably because they had studied Isaiah 5. And in verse 1 and in verses 6 through 7, let me read this passage to you. Isaiah is writing and he says, I will sing about the one I love, a song about my loved one's vineyard. The one I love had a vineyard on a very fertile hill. For the vineyard of the Lord of hosts is the house of Israel, and the men of Judah, the plant he delights in. He looked for justice, but saw only injustice. Looked for righteousness, but only heard cries of wretchedness. Pretty cool, huh? So Jesus is giving a parable where he's quoting essentially the story of Isaiah. And who's the vineyard? Israel. Now, at this point, a scribe comes to him and asks Jesus to clarify, okay, I think I'm with you here. What ultimately belongs to God, and what do we actually owe him? First, honest question. So one of the scribes approached and asked, which command is the most important of all? And Jesus replied, the most important is, listen, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your mind, and with all your strength. And they actually adds the with your mind, I think, in there. I can't remember exactly, but he actually modifies the Shema a little bit. Shema is something that devout Jews quote at least twice a day, in the morning and the evening, and sometimes more often. And they actually, in modern day, put it in a little scroll, and they put it up on the lintel on their door. And if you've been in an Orthodox Jewish house, every time they go in and out of the house, they hit it. They tap it, and then they repeat the Shema. Here's the Shema. In Deuteronomy 6, verse 4, listen, Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your strength. Yeah, it was mind that he added. These words that I am giving you today are to be in your heart. Repeat them to your children. Talk about them when you sit in your house and when you walk along the road and when you lie down and when you get up. Bind them as a sign on your hand and let them be a symbol on your forehead and write them on the doorposts of your house and on your gates. And at that time in first century Judea in Israel, they were putting them on the phylacteries. They were putting these scrolls in different places, and yet they weren't living it, were they? So this scribe asked the right question. Jesus gave the answer. And it gives us a principle to live by, and that is that it's all God's. It all belongs to Him. He He therefore is owed everything. Now, when my oldest daughter was about 3 or 4, she was asking me something, and I came up with this clever little thing. Gave her 3 rules in life. I said, honey, you'll do well in life if you just follow these 3 rules. I said, 1, daddy is in charge. 2, daddy is always right. And 3, everything belongs to daddy. Now, that was kind of tongue-in-cheek, but she's 3 or 4, and she already understands sarcasm. But she got it. She was kind of like, yeah, okay. Now, that worked out really well for a couple months until I had told her to do something or made some statement about, you know, this is the reality of the universe, and my wife had a slightly different opinion about something, and Rachel spouted off to Terry and quoted it. Well, I'm sorry, but daddy's in charge, daddy's always right, everything belongs to daddy, and you're wrong. So that infrastructure caved in, collapsed, and was destroyed. And of course, that's not theologically correct. You see, I polished it a bit for future generations of children where, and I told Zach this, I said that while everything belongs to God, he made me the steward of those possessions. And while I'm not always right, I turn to the scriptures and God is always right. And while I'm not really in charge, God has delegated me authority as the father of this house. Now, that just doesn't have the same zap to it. And I don't think he ever bothered to memorize that. But anyway, I'm not in any danger of that being shot back and quoted to my wife. God is the only one that's truly in charge for the simple reason that he's the creator. Okay? Now, why do you think the world desperately seeks to undermine God as the creator of the universe? Why do you think all the literature and all the buzz going on in the internet is that, well, there must be like some mindless process that created everything? It's because they instinctively know this simple thing, that the creator of a thing is the owner of it. Right? Make no mistake, God created the universe. To imagine that the universe always existed is to deny the current science. The facts of science show that the universe could not have always existed. And it still doesn't explain why it's here. To imagine that it created itself, which is literally what Stephen Hawking and some of these physicists are saying now, is that it created itself, is to deny logic. There's something missing there. And to imagine that a mindless force out there created the universe denies that the obvious design and thought that went into the universe exists. So they're saying that some mindless force just created it. No, it needs a mind to create the design. And there's a simple logical analysis. It's called the Kalam cosmological argument. It simply says that everything that begins to exist had a cause. Everything that begins to exist had a cause. And we've now proven through science that the universe began to exist. Therefore, the universe had to have a cause. Now, a 4-year-old can grasp that, but PhD physicists sometimes forget that. What is capable both intellectually and powerful enough to do this? What is? It has to be a mind, okay, because it has to think through the design of how to create this complex universe. It has to exist outside of space and time, and it has to be very powerful, omnipotent. That can only be God. That's the only answer. The universe couldn't create itself any more than you can pull yourself out of your own belly button. Now, because... Is that a visual? You know, when I go off script, things like this happen. I'm sorry. That's not in my notes. The universe didn't create itself, and we're part of the universe, true? We're part of the universe, our physical bodies. So as citizens of the universe, we don't own the universe. We are of the universe, but we don't own it because we didn't create ourselves. Ah, this is where the problem comes. We are creatures. We were created, and therefore we are owned by whomever created us. So now we have an obligation. We're owned. We're creatures. What do we owe our Creator? Well, we owe our Creator our very existence. We owe Him everything. Now, Jesus, this throwaway passage at the end of Mark, I think beautifully illustrates this. After all these arguments and dialogues with all these people testing Him, they're sitting in the temple near the collection box, and a poor widow comes and drops two tiny coins into the box. And Jesus calls this out. He summons His disciples and He says, I assure you that this widow has put in more than all those that were giving to the temple treasury before. For they gave out of their surplus, but she gave out of her poverty and has put in everything she possessed. She understood the fact that it wasn't hers. I am convinced that God took care of this woman in some way for the remainder of her life. If not in this life, then in eternity. And look at this beautiful passage about this woman that will be forever emblazoned in heaven. What an amazing act of faith. I am for one glad that I'm not my own master. And it's terribly sad that the priests and the Pharisees who knew the scriptures ignored this passage in Isaiah. And remember, they memorized all the time. They knew this passage in Isaiah 8. Let me just read this to you. You are to regard the Lord of hosts as holy. Only He should be feared. Only He should be held in awe. He will be a sanctuary. But for the two houses of Israel, He will be a stone to stumble over and a rock to trip over and a trap and a snare to the inhabitants of Jerusalem. Many will stumble over these and they will fall and be broken and they will be snared and they will be captured. That warning should have been ringing like an alarm bell. These Pharisees and Sadducees were more concerned about money and power and prestige and social standing. And the very Creator of the universe is standing before them saying, you owe me. You owe me. I created you. So now, leading into the next week's lesson, the stage is set. The testing and the observation is done. The plot has been hatched to murder the only innocent man in the history of the earth. The one who owns us and created us and sustains our very breath, the very life that we have, is going to allow them to make a choice and by relationship allow us to make the choice whether to reject Him or accept Him. And those who reject Him are rejecting Him in favor of their own sovereignty. Now just imagine that for a second. This is the most profound and amazing concept that I can imagine. That the very Creator who created us is allowing us the choice to ignore Him or accept Him. Please dwell on that this week as you go forth. And God bless you.